Before this episode of your favorite 1517 podcast begins, we would like to thank our listeners for partnering with us during our annual podcast fundraiser. Together, listeners like you joined the 1517 Podcast Network in raising $68,000 in support of our podcasting efforts. This financial support maintains and builds the 1517 Podcast Network's ability to declare and defend the good news that you are forgiven and free on account of Christ alone in every episode. Starting this week, there's a new opportunity for listeners to partner with us and help us improve the podcasting experience that 1517 creates. We have built a survey for podcast listeners to give us feedback and give us an idea of what kind of shows they do listen to, what kind of things they would like to listen to, and help us hone in some of the habits that we have on our shows. If you would like to partner with us, you can take the survey now by following the link in the show notes below. You might also receive an email from 1517 in the coming weeks outlining ways to take this survey. Thank you for partnering with us. Enjoy this episode of your favorite 1517 show.
Hello there, and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb Keith, and I am joined by my father, Scott Keith, by Adam Francisco, and by Bruce Hillman. The Thinking Fellows is brought to you by the 1517 Podcast Network of shows. You can go to 1517.org/podcasts to see all of our shows there. You can also just go to 1517.org, and on the homepage there, there is a display of all of our regular weekly content as it comes out. So you can see new podcast episodes, you can see the daily blogs up there, video content, and basically anything going on, conferences, speaking events, are all right there on the homepage, or you can navigate to your favorite things. And you can support this show by hitting the big red donate button on the website or following the link in this show notes, which is 1517.org/donate-podcasts with an S at the end. Mm-hmm. And that'll take you to a page where you can support this show and the rest of the 1517 podcast network. So, we're jumping through the magical list. I allowed Adam to pick this week's topic, which, you know, I thought was going to be like a very Adam topic then. And then it wasn't a very Adam topic. So
isn't how he says that too? He allowed you to pick the topic.
I did pick up on that. I'm like, yeah.
He says that kind of stuff to me all the time.
That's hilarious.
Yeah. And just for the record, Bruce and I talked about a topic, and because you and your dad were traveling a lot last week, we were like, well, let's choose something that's really like kind of easy. You know, it doesn't require any sort of Google searching or book reading.
Or anything, yeah.
That kind of stuff. And Bruce was like, oh, and this, let's do this one. I'm like, that should be an easy one, and it will be for you guys. Not for me. So what is our topic, Caleb?
Our topic is, we're going very early into the magical list, so Bruce must like this one because it came to him very quickly, which is, I think, did you say movies and TV shows, or is it movie?
It could be TV shows.
Yeah, so I guess cinema with...
Adam, so
with theological meaning. So you could take this a couple of ways. So, but basically, we could do this very similarly to our book episode that we did just a little while ago, where each person sort of had a recommended list. I guess you could do this as recommended or not.
Here's the problem with Adam in this topic. I'm going to explain it to you. Adam does not understand the purpose of going to a movie. He doesn't understand that it's for entertainment, okay? Because anytime he finally does go to a movie, it's something that's maybe is entertaining, but it's also something that's like uber serious with meaning, like he's reading a very important book on the topic. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure he saw 13 Hours.
Yeah.
Adam.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. we went and saw 1917 together. Yeah.
And remember the Rambo movie, Rambo 3?
Rambo was actually entertaining. So that doesn't count. And I drug you to that movie.
The role, right?
I drug you to that movie, just to be clear. He just went and saw The Sound of Freedom. The first movie he's probably seen in a movie theater since pre-COVID, I would assume.
You're right. I saw Shazam at the movie theater somewhere during COVID too, just for the record. I did see something fun.
I'm pretty sure the first Shazam just came out streaming.
No, that's the second one.
Okay. Well, at any rate, he goes to see movies that are like, he also refuses to read novels. And so he goes to see movies for the same way he reads books, just to like get more information on a topic. And so he just does not understand the idea of a movie or a TV show being an escape to something that's not necessarily real in order to be entertained or to get into a story that doesn't have to be a true story.
Yeah.
He just doesn't get it.
I also...
Truth is greater than fiction, bro.
Yeah. This topic is interesting to me because, like, sometimes when you say something has theological meaning, like a book, like a novel, let's say, or a story, or, and in this case, movie or TV, the problem is wanting to make then the whole thing actually then work with whatever meaning was implied or there. And I find that a lot of times, if there is a positive theological meaning to be found, because I think all movies are sort of theological in that people's worldviews and the way that they present and view and interact with the world is theological, whether they like it or not.
That's what I was thinking. This topic, it'd be harder to pick out a bunch of movies that had none.
But the problem is like, then the director or the writer's intent is not always the meaning that a Orthodox creedal Christian can pull out. And so I think you kind of have to stop with, I saw this symbol, or I saw this sign, or I saw this analogy, or I saw this thing, and it reminded me of this, and it's part of the great story, etc. But that's not the purpose of the movie a lot of times. Sometimes, maybe it is, but a lot of times, I think it's kind of a happy accident. And I think more times than not, so I'm curious what you guys do, when I see a theological meaning, it primarily overlaps with some sort of moral positive. So that's probably theological, but I think like a lot of the examples I can think of that are ones that I would want to bring up today are easier if it's more about like sort of living in this world than it is about actual theology, the heart of theology.
I just always go to this, that movies, I would even rephrase it, say movies with like kind of deep and probably deeper than you realize Christological themes. Because when you're writing fiction, it's such a universal theme that it's hard to get away from. So if you write a good movie, I'm doing In Defense of Tolkien here. If you write a good sort of story, you don't really have to be thinking, oh, I'm going to write Christ into the story. But the minute you write a hero who is willing to sacrifice everything for the good of the other people, you've just done it. This is the whole thing with archetype and eucatastrophe and all of Tolkien's sort of arguments for good fairy tales, is that they will have these elements, whether or not, and they're universal because they literally are universal. They are kind of written into the code of the universe. Once Christ, or Aslan sung it into existence. And
oh, wait, you, Scott, because, I mean, unless you're actually watching a Christian movie, which I don't recommend in most cases, because I know I'm going to upset people, but I just find them all so cheesy and overt. There's no trust that the audience can like interpret anything with Christian films a lot of times that bothers me. But when you watch like a regular film, to Scott's point, and I agree, like it's not what the author intended, that it's about how the story of Christ, well, all truth is God's truth, right? So like the story of Christ makes sense because it really happened in a real world with real people and real sin, and there was a real death and there was a real miracles and all that kind of stuff. And so if the writer of the movie or the show is a good storyteller, then Christians should be able to apply that story in some way, if it's well done, to the themes that they have been introduced to by scripture. And that can sometimes deepen your appreciation for what Christ did, even though the writer maybe didn't intend it. Like, so for an example, and this isn't from a movie, but this is just from a controversial piece of art when I was at seminary. There's a photograph taken, you might have heard of this, probably know about it, called Piss Christ. Have you guys remember?
Yeah.
From the 90s or the early 2000s. Yeah. It was a guy who took a crucifix and he put it in urine and he put some blood in it and he took a picture of it. And like the Vatican and everybody went nuts, you know, like it was against Christians and everything else. And the artist at the time didn't really comment on like what the meaning of it was. But you could look at it two ways. Like you could look at it like he was trying to be provocative and tick off Christians. And this was just a really offensive way to do it. Or you could look at it as a really good picture of the incarnation. It's like Christ entered our filth and shed his blood as a holy God for our sins. It's just how you want to interpret it. You could equally be offended or find it profound. Now that lends
the profundity of that particular one eluded me at the time.
Yeah, yeah, like that
and still eludes me. I'd like to wring that artist's neck, but I won't.
But I think good art, and I have problems with like abstract art and stuff, which would be another topic, I guess. But like, I think good art.
We should do that topic. I hate
it. It is relational, right? Like art requires you to bring something to it. It's not, and there's an interplay, and there's a bit of interpretation there that takes place. And if it's bad art, in my opinion, like bad art is, there's no interpretation that's needed. It's just, that's what makes it kitsch.
Remember, Scott, when we had that pretty lengthy conversation about, we were talking mostly about music, I think, but art in general was the major theme about whether there's an objectivity to it all.
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
See, here's my contradiction, though. I don't get abstract art, and I have like some philosophical issues with it, but I like jazz, which to me is basically the abstract art in music.
I really do not like
jazz. I guess my problem with art, too, is I do find that while you can reinterpret or find an alternative, that I have a desire for there to be a final interpreter of art.
That's not you.
That's well, maybe it is the, you know, the audience, but I think because audiences are so broad and so many different people can, it has to be in a lot of cases the, you know, the author, the executor of that art. So the director or the script writer or whatever, whoever is leading the ship on that, I think does kind of get the authority to say, that's not what I meant. Now, you could still say, well, you got, you know, in sort of my dad's Tolkien defense here, well, by accident or because of the nature of the world, you might not have meant this, but you couldn't escape it. I think there's a certain level of fairness there. I also think you have to take directors, authors, you know, artists seriously when they say, okay, but maybe this is my attempt at, you know, deconstructing that. So I couldn't escape it, but it was not meant to be a positive. And it might affirm that that's part of the world, but that my reaction to that is negative. I just think at some point you have to take the person of origin seriously if they say, this is not what I intended to do. And then there might be other similarities. So, for instance, I think The Matrix would be a sort of famous example.
To it by like
a famous, famous example of this, right? Where people say Neo is a Christ figure and very much so, that's not the intent. The intent is for it to be apparently Hinduism.
They shouldn't have him die on a cross then.
Well, and you might have, but you don't know what's not intentional blaspheming or miss, you know,
or have him resurrected in the final scene,
and
or Gnostic than Hindu.
Yeah, but they claim, yeah, so your directors claim this is the goal.
But what if they misunderstood Hinduism and Gnosticism, and that I'm just making a real point.
Yeah, you could, I guess, so you could.
This is my intention. My intention is to give you a Hindu film, but I gave you a Gnostic film. Like, does that mean that the meaning then is Hindu because they wanted it to be, but they were wrong?
Yeah, or maybe it reveals this something about world religions.
My point is like, yeah, like with scripture, it's different because you have the Holy Spirit who can preserve the author's intention. But with other things, when it comes to the author's intention, at some point you go,
yeah, you lost control of this.
Yeah, you like, it's not yours anymore. Like, you gave it to me.
Yeah.
You gave it to me. So
I agree. I totally agree with that. I think that what they actually meant to do matters less than what they actually accomplished. And so this is the whole problem with, I don't want to get into this, this is the whole problem with intentions, with somebody doing something and you're like, hey, you did this. And they're like, well, I didn't mean to do that. And you're like, well, doesn't matter. That's what happened. I won't say who I'm talking about. And at the end of the day, you know, it's, I just think these, I'm, again, in defense of Tolkien, I'm so with Tolkien on this stuff that if you write a good story, these themes are so part of every good story because they're universal, because they are part of God's story of redemption for his people. And
what was it? Was it Bruce Campbell? Is that who, the right guy I'm thinking of? Or who, you know, George Lucas was inspired by him to write Star Wars. He basically said, like, there's this mythos that you can follow in all the great stories.
Eternity in their hearts, or that guy. And it is Campbell. I forget the first name, though.
Yeah. So, Scott, to your point, yeah, I think Tolkien and Lewis were kind of, they were before him, but he's kind of synthesized all this and said, like, there's certain themes that grip us as humans, no matter what, you know, pan-cultural.
Yeah.
And if God has made us a certain way and sin has affected us a certain way, it would make sense that certain themes of rescue, for example, would appeal to our hearts.
Yeah. Yeah. And so what movies? Well, I'm gonna give you a surprise here. You ready? I'm not sure Bruce is ready for this. I'm gonna start with Mission Impossible series.
I just
I thought you were gonna go right for Lord of the Rings.
I just watched the first one for the first time.
Yeah, you gotta
really.
Yeah, you actually have to get to the fourth one, which is
interesting.
Ghost Protocol, because the first three basically follow the exact same formula. And they're just the first three, and I guess originally I stopped watching it at number two because it was just very formulaic. But at Ghost Protocol to Rogue Nation and Fallout, they really change gears where it is still, you know, very close to the formula of the first three, but they add this element in of the hero, Ethan Hunt, and his extreme desire to not let anyone else die in the process of this. And he's willing to do anything, even risk like the biggest catastrophe you could think of in order to save even one person. The person he will always put at risk is
himself.
And any extreme risk in order to save any individual person. And I just think it rings with, the themes of God does not want anyone to perish, but to come to the knowledge of the truth, and rings of sacrifice. And, now I'm maybe stretching it a little bit, but, at the same time,
the new Overlord theme that's in it as well.
Yeah, well, you get this. I don't know. I'll just say, I teared up a little bit in those Mission Impossible movies.
Rewatching I mean,
they hit more than just an action movie. Is all I'm saying. There was something there.
And they do have the best stunts of any film. Like,
yeah, but they hit the last three. There were redemptive themes there that were so strong that they actually elicited emotion.
On a different,
if you want to hear something funny, you use the name Ethan Hunt.
Yeah.
That's the main character. I thought that was an actor. So I'm like on my phone.
Tom Cruise.
That's Tom Cruise.
That's Tom Cruise. This is going to be such a hard episode for Adam.
I'm pathetic.
I was just, is on a non-theological note, but just commenting on, you know, watching Mission Impossible for the first time. It's one of those ones where, like, the action was so quasi-realistic for 85% of the movie that then at the end jumps the shark with the final action sequence with the helicopter in the tunnel.
Yeah.
That you're like, why did we suspend, like why was this so realistic all the way to the end? There's a couple other movies like that are always
kind of dated now, though, too, those effects, like for the first one.
Only in the end, again, like only once you get to that helicopter stuff. Before that, it's all practical effects.
It was actual stunts.
Masks and stuff. Like, if you're into the Joe Biden's dead mask conspiracy, that movie is not one to watch because you'll be convinced it's definitely possible.
That is definitely, that's one of the formulas that they keep doing in every movie, too, in all of them.
Masks, yeah.
Master of disguises position.
They actually start making fun of it in the third movie once Jeremy Renner comes on board.
Because he's willing to put on a disguise in like every circumstance.
Yeah. Jeremy Renner comes on board and he's like, oh, The Mission Impossible team put on a mask. It's kind of funny. So fool world leaders. This works every time.
But I guess another one you could pull from that is that the enemy operates by deception and lies.
Yep.
That's another kind of common one. The enemy operates purely in deception.
Well, the enemy in these movies is always a deceiver.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. Well, Bruce, you wanna go on for one?
Yeah, so probably none of you have seen this. This is a comedy, actually, but it's a dark comedy. And it's not a Christian film, but it deals with a Christian theme purposefully. It's a Danish film called Adam's Apples, and it stars Mads Mikkelsen.
Who I absolutely have never seen it.
Yeah. He's the villain in the Indiana Jones film right now, and he's the villain in James Bond. You would recognize him. He does a lot of English films as well. But Adam's Apples is the name of the film, and it is a retelling of the Book of Job in the modern way, loosely retelling of the Book of Job. And it really, the redemptive themes are really, really strong in it, but of course it's a dark comedy, so you don't really, it's like sometimes you laugh, and then other times you don't know if you should laugh. And by the end of the film, it sort of hits you like, you don't know what side you would have been on with Jesus in a way. You don't know how to think about suffering anymore. So the plot, the very basic plot is this guy, Mads Mikkelsen, is a Danish priest in the countryside who takes in parolees when they get out of prison for like a month or two. They live and do their work at the church before they can be put back in public. And he gets this one who's a neo-Nazi who gets out. And they just clash. Their personalities are so different. Mads Mikkelsen's character is just always willing to suffer for the good of others, always. But this guy picks up on that right away. And so then he says, basically, I'm going to take advantage of this. Like, I want to see how much I can make him suffer. And then he's going to learn that the goodness he believes in and the love and God and all this stuff, that he's going to learn it's not worth it. Because he hasn't suffered enough yet. So he starts inflicting all these sufferings on the guy. And then the guy has a crisis of faith. He has to kind of work through it. And the film is about other cast of characters, parolees and stuff who are around there. It's actually not a very long film. I think it's like a little over an hour and 15 minutes or an hour and 20 minutes. You can get it on Amazon and rent it. But it's a very interesting film. And I think it gives you a new sense of the suffering servant in a way you don't see coming. But Adam's Apples.
All right. Caleb, you're up. Because, I mean, we can ask Adam, but...
I think anybody who has talked to me about movies will not be surprised by this one. So I'm going to go the opposite direction of you. But my pick, like off the top of my head, for ones that have impacted me that I like, is Blade Runner.
There's a lot in Blade Runner.
Particularly, I think it comes to a nice explicit.
He's talking about the newer one, right?
Yes, but I think it that obviously continues from. Okay. But 2049 in particular, so the new one with Ryan Gosling and Harrison Ford.
You know who Harrison Ford is, right, Adam?
Yes. That was funny.
They get him confused with Kevin Costner.
Oh, no.
Now, I think one of the running question in both of them, both Blade Runners, is what does it mean to be a person? What, and that question is brought up, and this is a common theme with anything with androids in it. Am I a person? And so your main characters in this are a class of androids that are originally invented to replace sort of labor and to become slave labor, because if men can create it, it must not be ensouled, even if they're human. And so these replicants are, though, flesh and blood. And
yeah, they look completely human.
They look completely human. They are biological. They're programmable by biological programming. So there's a technological aspect to it where
it's not androids as in metal and wire, but in sort of programmed humanoids.
Westworld style.
Westworld style through biological creation. So it has some science implications as well as what's the limits of human technology. Once we get past wires, if you can create flesh and blood in the lab.
Which they did 2 weeks ago. Did you read about that? Synthetic.
I did. Yeah. It's always going. It's always
14 days. 14 days they had a synthetic human alive.
And,
what?
Embryos. Yeah,
they took embryos and they were completely synthetic and they were completely like indistinguishable from true human embryos for 14 days. And then they killed them.
We live in a scary world. But the question is so if you can create people in a lab, are they human? And the movies propose that the
immediate... Why don't you guys tell me the news?
I don't know.
you live in a mountain.
Yeah, you're safe.
The movies propose that the immediate answer of our society would be no, right? And because we would have this new class of people to leverage, and you always need that. And then the struggle of the movie is sort of a subset
they don't
of them.
Know that all the replicants become Marxists, and right. They're back to the problem.
Yeah. is that a certain group of them become more sentient, can the biological programming doesn't hold, start having these existential thoughts and dread about are they ensouled? And it turns out like...
This is like every robot movie ever.
Every robot movie ever.
iRobot, Westworld.
Yeah. But I think the difference here is that towards the end, by the time you get to start asking questions of some of these replicants is, does having work, like even more free work, give you purpose or meaning? Is that where ontological meaning comes from?
Mm.
No. Does having sexual relationships, is that like, is having sexual relationships or romantic relationships where your meaning comes from? It looks like, well, we're getting closer, but no. And then it gets to, well, what about if you could have children?
It's reproduction.
And the answer is yes.
Yeah.
And then once a subset of them find out that a replicant had a baby, which is supposed to be impossible, that's when they start believing that they're people. And what you find is in 2049, Ryan Gosling's character, who does not know if this child is real or not, but just based on the hope that there is a replicant child out there, is willing to do everything, give his life for everything, just to find out if... that's the hope for them. If the hope is they can procreate, they can have children. And so I find that it's theological in the sense that command and blessing from God that is actually given to us, be fruitful and multiply, is...
the one that more and more we're rejecting.
The one we're more and more rejecting, the one that we're rejecting overtly by killing children in the womb, the one that we... reject sort of inversely by promoting things like career and companionship relationships above that and finding your meaning outside of that, is that the real human creature is driven towards this familial relationship, this procreative relationship, and that it is a meaning beyond just yourself. It gives you meaning because it's something outside of you. So I find that's kind of the overrunning, like that's the theme of that. There's a lot of moral themes in there, but I think that one's less moral. So it's not like a moral, you must have kids in there, but it is the human meaning finally has, when it's something outside of itself, its own pleasure, its own work, but a life that it can live for and sacrifice for, there is meaning there. So
that was good.
All right, Adam. Now the uncomfortable silence.
We gave you half an hour.
Yeah.
What did you watch on your phone right now that you can now comment on? What TV show did you watch from last half hour? Go, oh, this was great.
No, I did see as I mentioned earlier, or somebody, Scott mentioned, I did go see The Sound of Freedom, which is more of it's meant to correspond to actual world events. I have for a long time heard of human trafficking, sex trafficking, and always being kind of skeptically inclined, always wondered. And I always ask people like Raleigh Sadler, like, is this hyperbole? is it really this bad? And he always says, no, it is. It's terrible. It's the, you know, the claim that there are more slaves in the world today than ever have been ever. I always thought that just can't be. So I've kind of, it's kind of been a little special interest of mine, but this, the Sound of Freedom tracks the story of Tim Ballard, this former Department of Homeland Security. I don't know if they're called officers or agents, who is in charge of that. And he deals, he mostly goes after it in his career for DHS, traffickers within the United States. But then I think, remember correctly, it's only been like 3 days and I still can't remember, or I now can't remember all the details of the movie, but he's able to rescue a child, and that kind of changes things. The thing, though, the theological or more moral theme is this guy's sense of, there's little snapshots of this guy in vocation in the movie. There's little snapshots with his family. He's got, I think he has 6 kids, and his wife is there, and his wife is just like this, and again, it's very short little snapshots, but just supports him and his mission 100% while raising what, at least in the movie, seems like just a solid, normal family. But then the guy goes, he has to, so with Tim Ballard, Jim Caviezel, I think is how you pronounce the actor's name.
Yeah. Yeah.
He kind of senses that he has a vocation not within DHS. He has to leave his profession, and then he goes down and starts, I mean, long story short, goes past arresting people, trafficking, pedophilic kind of stuff on the internet, and actually goes and starts rescuing children. And one of the lines in the movie that sticks out, and it's not like, I mean, it is profound, but it doesn't seem all that profound, but it's God's children are not for sale. And I'm not sure where that comes from, but that's his life's mission in a nutshell. And as I understand it, that's still his life's mission. And he's got, I mean, it's a remarkable, there's a side character in the movie. He's this, I forget his name, Pablo or something, who's a billionaire or something. And he's actually, just because he wants to do good, funding a lot of the stuff to make it all happen and rescuing children. So nothing like, you know, deep theological, but that's, as you made fun of me earlier, Scott, that's sort of the stuff I like.
Corresponding to reality.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm kind of a simpleton that way.
Adam's got no time for make-believe.
Well, I do. You know, there's, you know what? I watched, when Bruce and I decided on the steam, I was like, oh, crap, I got to watch some movies. So I watched Shawshank Redemption. I'm like, for sure, there's going to be a redemptive theme in this.
Not really.
Yes, there is, but it's like,
not as strong as you would think, given the title.
I know, yeah. But you know, it's another good
movie. The Redemption is... has more of a redemption in it than Shawshank Redemption.
What does?
The Green Mile. Yeah.
Yeah, well, so I asked Rachel this morning. I was like, man, we're going to be doing this, and I don't know. And she's like, The Green Mile. I'm like, oh, yeah, but it's been a while since I've seen that, so I can't.
Yeah, it's been a while since I've seen it, too. I think Shawshank is a better movie, which is why I end up watching it more.
Morgan Freeman's just a stud when it comes to being an actor, his voice and all that.
Yeah.
We watched Hacksaw Ridge with my youngest the other day. I really like that. That sense of duty and principle. You've all seen that?
I haven't. I know about it. I haven't.
That's the one with a Spider-Man guy, right? He's a medic.
Yeah. He's a Seventh-day Adventist, I think.
Not Tom Holland, the other one.
A pacifist. I'm not a big fan of pacifism.
Yes.
But yeah, the way he puts everything on the line just to save people, sacrifices his own security to save others. So there was once I was on a submarine a long time ago, a submarine that once hit the bottom of the ocean. I was reminded of last week as everybody's talking about that one little submarine.
You like accidentally hit the bottom of the ocean?
Yeah. In our house, I don't know if you saw it on my mantle, is like a little square of HY-80 steel.
Yeah.
It actually comes from the hull of that submarine.
So like a Navy submarine accidentally hit the bottom of the ocean.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway.
The relative bottom, somewhere within 1,000 feet, or else it would have.
Yeah, but in the galley, you know, where you eat, there was a little plaque commemorating some operation or deployment with one of the SEAL teams that said, greater love hath no man, and then he lay his life down for his friends. And that always just kind of has stuck with me. That's sort of like one thing. I guess if there's a theme that I really like in movies, it's that one.
Then you should watch Mission Impossible.
No. And you should watch Blade Runner.
Well, I have probably seen Mission Impossible, but maybe I wouldn't.
Have you guys seen Silence, Martin Scorsese's film?
Yeah. Yeah.
No.
That one is...
Maybe?
I watched that with my mother-in-law, and maybe she's listening, so I got to be a little careful. But she says, what would you do? It was like that last where he's given... I forget who. Is it Keanu Reeves? No, it's
Andrew Garfield.
That's the same guy as Hacksaw Ridge, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Who I can't think of his name right now. Who? Adam Driver and Liam Neeson.
There's that priest. He's given that's the option. You could trample on a crucifix.
Yeah.
Or you're going to hang upside down and slowly bleed out.
Yeah.
And he chooses the
it's
ladder.
A real thing. So it's based, yeah. There was a real guy named Father Ferreira, who is a Portuguese father who, in the 1500s, under the Japanese Tokugawa persecution, supposedly apostated and ended up working for the Japanese to help them flush out Christians. And so a Japanese writer, Christian writer, which is extremely rare, named Shusaku Endo, he actually wrote this novel called Silence, which raises real... I mean, it's a fan... You should read it as a book. It's a small book.
You know, now that you're saying this, I remember when this came out.
Yeah, it's called Silence. And it asks the question of, like, what is real faith? And is your faith... Do you really... Like, is your faith really a product of God? And does he keep you in faith? Like, is God helping preserve your faith? Or is your faith a thing you have to keep producing? And what do you do... And how, persecution is the lens that he uses to bring out these faith themes. And so there's really like prototypes in the book and in the film. There's the Adam Driver character who's like all in. Like he's going to die for his faith if he has to. He's a true believer, like all the way. And then there's this Japanese Christian who continually, when faced with persecution, runs away, but continually comes back. And so he's the prodigal son over and over again, and it tests your patience. Like, would God keep forgiving someone like this? Is he even really a believer? And you hate this character, but he's actually the most human of all the characters that you're presented with. There's Ferreira, who's the priest, who's the theologian, who knows all the right things, but who is, because of that, is able to somehow live with the contradiction that helping the Japanese and persecuting the Christians isn't really all that bad. And he just is able to live with that contradiction, which most people can't. And then there's the main character, which is Rodriguez, which is played by Andrew Garfield, who's us on this journey with all these prototypes, trying to figure out what would we do. It's called Silence because in the face of persecution, you know, will God actually speak? Like, why does he seem silent? And that's C.S. Lewis's words in Great Divorce, right? Why does he seem so silent when... you can knock on the door when everything's going well and he opens up and there's lights on and there's music playing and it's great. But real calamity happens and the lights are off and you knock and you hear bolting and double bolting on the other side and all that. So it plays on all those themes. I can't recommend the book high enough. The book is, of course, always better than the film. But the film is actually very true to the book, except Scorsese ends, the very ending of the movie is different than the book. And he did that because there's no way to... If you read the book, there's no way to get the right ending if Scorsese didn't add the little 2-minute ending that he did, because it's inferred in the book. But the film is really well done. Really well done.
Yeah. That sounds really sad.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
So, but you should watch
it. Sounds like the type of movie Adam would like.
Yes. So, well, he already watched it.
So my mother-in-law asked me at the end of it, she goes, what would you do? Would you trample on the cross? Knowing that it's just a piece of
on the cross, you go free.
Yeah, knowing that it's just a symbol, but also knowing that is it a tribe of Japanese Christians? If for them it's very meaningful, and my response, I think, was like, well, I would stomp it out, and then I'd come back and kill every one of those tyrants.
I think it'd be I think one of the the things with the persecution book, kind of narrative, and we see this in just like people's like, what would you do in Christian history as well, is like it's theoretical for us in America. It's basically theoretical, but I always run it through. Like, it's hard to detach myself from the life I have when I ask that question, in the sense that I'm not just me in a prison camp. I have a whole family that depends on.
They go into that with the Japanese Christian book.
And so what, you know, would my wavering in persecution have to do with my ability to suffer, or the people that, if I'm killed, are also left, you know.
Listen, there were the Christians that were in Rome that were persecuted for being Christians, and there were the Christians who hid it and still worshipped and spread the gospel in the catacombs. So neither one of those is a better Christian for the direction they took.
Silence is, I think, though, the best novel I have ever read that just totally, absolutely, fully, and completely destroys the theology of glory. You just can't finish that book. When you finish that book, you will either know that you believe in a theology, still believe in a theology of glory, or you'll have no grounds to believe in a theology of glory anymore. There's just no way to get to the end of that book, and it completely destroys it. In a way that makes you so uncomfortable, though, because you're like, I still do believe in the theology of glory a bit. It's still in there. It's still in my heart a little bit, isn't it? Because the book gets you there.
Mm.
All right.
Oh, interesting.
Well,
that's good. We got 4 or 5.
There's probably, you know, like 1,000 other movies to bring up to do this, but I think one of the themes you can take away.
Indeed.
I've got a whole list of them.
Is that
Adam has no movies left.
I mean, did we name one where...
Well, no, we didn't go to Shazam. You could do Shazam at some point.
I mean, we didn't name... I think every single one we named, he had a character that either died or is willing to die for others.
Yeah.
You know, that's the...
true.
That's one of the, like, the big ones. It's definitely, like, through those various contexts, it's not even a trope in the sense that it's not like, oh, of course, this person's gonna die. It's like, once it's done well, it's actually it's like the closure of the meaning of the movie is the realization that they really would have sacrificed everything
get the catastrophe, you get the last minute turn.
Like, yeah,
I love those.
Yes, love
that's that last minute turn. Hope is lost.
That's why, for me, like the end of 2049 is the eucatastrophe is in the last scenes. Yeah. Like the catastrophe and the eucatastrophe happen in the last 5 minutes, and it's all one.
When Gandalf shows up on the hill,
yes,
Helm's Deep. Like, yeah. That's
yes,
all the feels.
Yeah, and it just it kind of changes the game. So it's. Movies are cool for that. You can sort of experience those
moments. Curious. I do have to ask this. I am curious. So, Scott, what did you think of the versions of the movies of Narnia?
Oh, I liked them. I thought so they only did 3 of them.
Right.
Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe is the best of the 3.
I agree.
The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, which is the 3rd one they did, is the 2nd best of the 3. And
yeah.
The Prince Caspian is the one that's mostly just like a movie. So
I think... I feel like they suffered from coming after Lord of the Rings. Like, if they were made first, I feel like they would have done...
I think Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe was good. Like, you have... I mean, it's hard to get around the fact that Aslan is Christ. Like, that's just like... That book does that, and the movie can't escape that, even if it's Disney producing it, right? And then I think you're right, Voyage, you actually have Aslan, like, you know, fulfilling the promise of eternal life to somebody
on screen. Yeah, when Reepicheep goes over the wave into Aslan's country, it's, you know, it's the hope of
and
the life of the world to come. I mean, he is the Elijah character, right? So,
yeah.
It's very good.
It is very good. They just like, and maybe it's credit to Lewis. He just wrote it in a way where, like, it'd be hard to make those movies without being just horribly unfaithful. Yeah.
The best thing they get across in the Prince Caspian movie is the redemption of Edmund.
That was actually well done.
Yeah.
Good job doing it.
Yeah. Because you even leave, and you get the Eustace scene is actually pretty good, too, so. But, that's Voyage of the Dawn Treader, so. But the redemption of Edmund is good. The Prince Caspian's, it's not my favorite book either, so that sort of tracks. They're also, it's kind of funny, they did the movies. We just had an order conversation in our family for the Narnia movies. They did the movies in the original publication order too, instead of the way that they publish them now, which is starting with the Magician's Nephew and doing it in Narnian chronological order.
Yeah, I think they should have gone that route.
Well, you probably would have had an audience, and I think the reason they did it with the movies is because the only one most people have read is Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe. So that's the hook, I think, for a movie, to do that one first.
I think if you do C.S. Lewis chronologically, if you do Narnia chronologically, people will not keep going. I actually think Magician's Nephew, if you don't already know what happened in Narnia, is less meaningful to people. So you need
characters
in The Witch and the Wardrobe.
The characters are less poignant.
Yeah. Like the impact of who the witch is and the releasing her into the world happens because you know the story. It'd be like telling people about the devil and the creation of the world in a sort of Gnostic way first, and then telling them why they should care about Jesus. I think you should tell people about Jesus first, like get to the Gospels first, and then teach them about things like the devil and the origin.
I wouldn't say the chronological order, but publishing The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe first, and then doing Narnian history after that, is the way you teach children Christianity. You teach them about...
Tolkien did too, with similar other stuff. He was going back.
You teach children about Jesus first, and then you tell them all the Bible stories.
That's true.
And so that's what he originally did. Now, it's funny, I think we brought this up when we did Lewis, is that later in life, he actually says, oh, I probably should have published them in Narnian chronological order. But I think
he did the right thing.
You can do either one, especially if you're reading them with your kids who already know about Jesus. You can certainly start with Magician's Nephew. But for the movies, I think they had to do Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. It's the only one people really know, and it's their hook to get people in the series.
Yeah. I don't think you should start Star Wars with the first movie, though, with episode one.
Oh, chronologically, you shouldn't do it chronologically?
It's not as much of a hook as the New Hope.
You got to start with New Hope and then go back.
I agree with that. New Hope is definitely a much bigger hook than... Phantom Menace.
Jar Jar.
There's so much you won't understand about what's going to happen in Star Wars if you start with Phantom Menace.
Yeah, that's true. Well, guys, very very good.
Adam's like, yep, I agree.
We're gonna for Adam's sake and for the listeners, we will wrap this one up.
We should do a Star Wars one. I would totally into that. We can do...
Adam will be traveling that week, but...
We can do Clone Wars. We can do Rebels.
Oh,
we can do,
This is now the cinema podcast. This is the Star
Wars. You know what I like better than Star Wars, though? It's Star Trek.
I'm down for that, too, baby. Yeah, we didn't even bring it up.
I'm a big Trekkie as well.
We didn't bring up redemptive issues between Captain Janeway and Seven of Nine or Picard and Data.
No, we're good. We can't go down this rabbit hole, but yes. No, we're good. As you can tell, guys, we watch a lot of TV and movies. Except for
Adam. If we did Star Trek, you only have like 200 or 270 something shows to watch.
To catch up on. But, thank you for listening to this episode of the Thinky Fellows podcast. Again, part of the 1517 podcast network of shows. You can go to 1517.com/podcast to see. Oh, wait, is it com? No, it's 1517.org/podcast.
Yeah.
To see all of our shows there. You just also follow the links in the show notes. Our show notes have expanded recently, so you should go check those out. You can look on your phone. You can just swipe down from the description of the show, and there are a bunch of links to things that are going on at 1517 right now, including the links to things like our Support Us page and our podcasts on the website. So we will catch you next time. Bye.